for our last discussion, I thought I would. There are a few points that I want to make just to bring certain parts of our discussion to an end, and then we'll open it up for questions. So I hope to leave a lot of time today for questions. So feel free to raise those questions about what we discussed today, or if there are lingering questions from previous discussions, I'd be happy to take those. So again, just within this general theme that we've been looking at this week, the person and the polis, we've been looking specifically at Aquinas' doctrine of the common good and seeing how it is that the person relates to the polis. How, as I said at the beginning, there's nothing more natural in the world for the person to be a member of the polis, to be a part of the polis. And we just, by using Deconic as a guide, helping us to understand how it is that the good of the city is a natural and perfective good of the human person. So again, looking at the good in general, how it's an object of desire, it's bears the note of final cause, it's the first of causes, and is diffusive of itself. We also looked in how for Aquinas, various goods diffuse themselves differently according to, let's say, the concentration of goodness that they possess, the degree to which they participate in image, represent God's own goodness. They diffuse themselves either to many effects at once, or to few, or to one. And how among these various goods, according to their various extension, they are goods of the human person according to various categories, according to various formalities of the human person, whether we're considering him as a mere individual, as a member of a species, genus, as a creature in general, under each of these formalities, various goods, according to the various extensions, become proper to and perfective of the human person. And that's where we left off yesterday, by examining Aquinas' doctrine of the bonum suum. And looking at Aquinas' teaching, we saw how, for Aquinas, the human individual pursues and enjoys his higher proper goods, not qua individual, but qua member of a species, qua member of a genus, qua member of participated being. And it's according to these formalities, then, that the common good of the family, the common good of the city, the common good of the universe, and finally God, all goods common in causando, appear as goods proper to the human creature. And all of this is important, then, and just looking at human life practically, looking at human life from the point of view of moral considerations, it's important to note, based on Aquinas' doctrine of the bonum suum, that the human individual enjoys his higher goods not qua individual. He doesn't pursue them simply qua individual, still less can he love them qua individual, but rather qua part of some greater whole. The very structure, the ontological makeup of the goods that perfect the human creature, especially his common goods, demand this kind of love. Those goods that are flush with goodness, that extend their effects to many at once, cannot be loved simply by the individual for the sake of the individual himself. They have to be loved, according to Aquinas, in their communicability, in their wide diffusion, as shareable, as shared, and in view of the real relations then with others that the common good stands as the principle. As we've already seen, you know, for Deconic, he summarizes this well, that members of a family don't come, together in the family. How does he say it? That the family isn't the result of kind of necessarily their own choice in coming together. It's not that they choose to love each other and then the family emerges, but rather the principle of the family, their own family, the good of their own family, pre-exists their own choice to love and becomes the very principle and reason for their love for each other. On page 225 of the dissertation, I try to summarize this point in this way. Deconic demonstrates through his completed portrait of the human person, that the individual's inclusion as part of a greater whole, be it of an earthly family, an earthly city, the universe, or the heavenly city, does not obscure, but rather reveals the grandeur of personal dignity. Again, it's not just the mere possession of intellect and will that makes the human person great. But what makes the human person great is that by reason and by will, he can strive for and love and possess goods that lie beyond the limits of just his individual good. He can love and embrace the goods of his species, even the good of his genus, and finally, the universal good of all, by these powers, by intellect, and by will. So again, man has reason and will not because he is great, but because his goods are great. There's a point that we passed over quickly yesterday. I mentioned it in one of the passages that I read, but didn't really explain it once. And I'd like to take a moment to say a bit about what Aquinas has to say about God and the act of creation, and what he does in the act of creation. How it is that God's goodness is reflected in creation, and how he creates in such a way that his goodness is reflected in creation. Aquinas is aware that, you know, it's in many and diverse goods that the human creature finds its perfection. So why are there, you know, these many and diverse goods? Why does God create not only a multiplicity of a particular kind of thing, but a diversity, you know, of kinds of things? What Aquinas, how he treats this or attempts to explain it or describe, give an account for it, is that when you look at God himself and in his own goodness, we can look at him from kind of appreciate two aspects of the divine being. First of all, there's the subjective aspect of God, and God who is truth, who is love, God who knows and who loves, who by volition, free choice, creates. And so we speak of God, we address God as a subject, and a kind of trinity of subjects, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So there's the subjective aspect of the divine good, but there's also an objective aspect of the divine good. God is, or the divine nature as a lovable object, as a lovable thing, is that which God loves in himself, you know, his own divine goodness. So insofar as you have subjective and objective aspects to the divine nature, Aquinas says it's not surprising that you're going to find within creation, insofar as creation reflects God's goodness, reflections of these subjective and objective qualities or dimensions of the divine good. And here's Aquinas makes a distinction in how it is that creation reflects the divine goodness and how creatures reflect the divine goodness. You really have two categories of reflections of the divine goodness in creation, according to whether the creature is reflecting the subjective or the objective quality of the divine good. And so Aquinas says there are two kinds of reflections of the divine goodness in creation among creatures. Intensive and extensive. These are not English words, by the way. These are Latin words. It just so happens that they map on quite well with our English use of them. You know, there are ways in which creatures reflect God's goodness intensive, and another way in which creatures reflect God's goodness extensive. The intensive or the intensive. The subjective quality of the divine good and the extensive reflection
of the divine goodness in creatures reflects the objective quality of God's goodness. There are some creatures that reflect God's goodness intensively, according to a varying scale, but there are some, there's one, so intensively that he himself, that creature himself, is a subject. So just in the whole scope of material creation, we'll kind of leave the angels out for a second. We can see that there are, specifically in the animate world, in the world of animate creatures, an increasing scale of what we might call the intensive reflection of God's goodness in creation. Beginning with, single-cell creatures that are principles of their own activity all the way up to the human creature. In all of them there's, and because they're the principles of motion, principles of action, increasingly principles of comprehension, principles of volition. Finally getting to the human creature, you have in us a creature that reflects God's goodness so intensively that we reflect, in fact, something of God's own subjectivity. We can know, we can love, we govern our own actions, we're responsible for them. We can do the kinds of things that God does as a subject. But that doesn't exhaust the reflection of God's goodness in creation. There's a whole other category of reflection of the divine goodness. That's extensive, which reflects the objective quality of God's goodness. And the more these objects, the more these creatures, created things, I should say, reflect God in his objective goodness, they in themselves extend their own goodness to many things at once. Insofar as God objectively is the universal good, extending his goodness to all things as their first cause and final end, you see that divine extension of the divine goodness reflected in creation in those goods that can and do extend their own goodness to many effects, to many beings at once, without being divided. They're shareable not just in predication, but in actual cause, in actual effect. That's a very helpful distinction. It's actually rather beautiful when you begin to consider the implications of this. We'll talk a bit about in a second, but just to highlight one thing, Aquinas has in view that within the created order, how it is that creation reflects in itself something of the divine goodness. You have these, in a sense, two tracks of representation. But there's a real relation between the intensive and extensive reflections of God and creation. They're not opposed to each other. They don't come into conflict. But according to God's own design, how it is that the order of the whole, intensive and extensive reflections being within, we can actually say that that creature creatures that intensively reflect the divine goodness, or oriented to and perfected by the goods that extensively reflect the divine goodness. And it's through the intensive pursuit of the extensive goods that something of God and something greater of God's own goodness is reflected in creation. Is that all clear? I mean, does that make sense? I mean, just in terms of the basic distinction. Yeah.
Can you just clarify the intensive and the subjective aspect of God's goodness?
Right. I mean, insofar as I think there is a way in which you can see that. I mean, for the human creature, that our reflection of the divine goodness, insofar as God's is a subject, is so intense. I mean, we, in a sense, contain within ourselves. I mean, such an intensive participation in God's own goodness that we ourselves emerge as subjects, you know, like God. And it is. I mean, the two terms do trade on each other because one, in a sense, kind of negates the other. I mean, they are a pair. You know, to be intensive is not to be extensive, and to be extensive is not, in a sense, to be intensive. So that they really are kind of two distinct modes, one kind of negating the other, but they're complementary by God's design within creation. And insofar as God's both subject and object, we see subjective and objective kind of representations of his goodness in creation. Some creatures so intensively participating in God's goodness that they themselves, you know, show something of intellect, will, and us, it's the highest perfection of that, where we ourselves, I mean, are true subjects. But others, in a way that the intensive, or the creatures that intensively reflect the divine goodness don't, they reflect the divine goodness extensively, in kind of the objective quality of the divine goodness, as an object to be loved, as an object that is a principle of desire, you know, has the note of final cause, diffuses itself. Persons don't stand before other persons in that way, as ends, in that sense. Despite our really intensive participation in God's goodness, we don't extend our goodness, you know, to many at once, in that kind of way. We're not transcendent goods in that kind of sense. Not like the good of the family, the good of the city, the good of the order of the universe. So there's, in a sense, no subjective personal quality to those goods, but they do something that we can't, which is to say, to stand as final ends and diffuse their goodness to many once in that way. And that's actually good for us. It's by God's design that we exist in a created order with this kind of dual mode of representation of the divine goodness. I think an implication for our discussion this week is, you know, it's important to realize how this doctrine, this aspect of Aquinas' doctrine of creation, secures for us a doctrine of human dignity. Or at least we should appreciate how this doctrine secures for Aquinas a real doctrine of human dignity. I try to summarize this on page 258, 259 of the dissertation, if you want to follow along. For de Coninck, the question that the personalist should ask himself, and really it's not just the personalist, it's anyone, anyone who's interested in the question of dignity should ask, when pondering human dignity, is not why God creates personal beings as willed and governed for themselves, but rather why these beings constitute only one type of creature in the cosmos. In de Coninck's words, what is the end that God proposes in the production of things? When he says the production of things, de Coninck signifies God's production of many types of things, as well as many instances of a thing within each type. By raising this question, de Coninck argues that all inquiry into the unique gifts of personal beings must consider how these unique gifts relate persons both to other creatures and to the whole that persons constitute within them. In other words, any inquiry into personal existence that prescinds from exploring non-personal existence will overlook much that pertains to personal existence, at least in what concerns a person's shared presence in the cosmos. For de Coninck, therefore, the key question for the study of human dignity is this: what is God's purpose in placing personal and non-personal beings within the same created, ordered whole? And de Coninck, even though he's a philosopher, a theologian, he's also kind of a good lawyer. He doesn't ask questions you know, the answers to which he doesn't already know.
And so he's got a text of Aquinas at hand to answer the questions he raises. And so that's what I have first on your handout for today, a passage from the Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 3, Chapter 64. It's a marvelous section, these chapters in Book 3, where Aquinas, just kind of step by step, looks at the reality of creation and ponders God's purposes in creating, what he has created. So this isn't just kind of idle speculation. I mean, he's looking around at what is and is trying to come up with an account for why we have what is within creation. So, Summa Contra Gentiles 3:64. God has produced all things in being, not from the necessity of nature, but through intellect and will. Otherwise, not through any kind of compulsion or need, but by the free choice of his own intellect and will. Now, the final end of God's intellect and will can be nothing than his own goodness. As plainly, he communicates his goodness to things. So when God creates, I mean, what does he have in view? Himself and his own goodness. And he creates in such a way that what he creates images, reflects, participates in his own goodness. Accordingly, things participate in the divine goodness by way of similitude insofar as they are good. Now, this is the important part. Now, that which is best among caused things is the order of the universe, which is the most perfect thing, as the philosopher says. This is confirmed by sacred scripture. Don't just take Aristotle's word for it. Moses says the same thing. It's confirmed by sacred scripture, which says in Genesis 1, right at the very beginning, you don't have to go far into the Bible to find confirmation of this. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. That's, of course, what he says at the end of the sixth day. Aquinas observes, however, when God saw his singular works, days 1 through 5, he said simply that they were good. That's already interesting, I mean, to note Aquinas' interpretation here of, you know, the first creation story. I mean, usually when we get to the way we tend to read, you know, the 6 days of creation, once, you know, what happens at the end of the 6 days, the creation of a new person, male and female, God says it's very good, and what do we say? Well, you know, we're kind of the capstone, you know, of creation. Things aren't very good, you know, until, it's just good until we arrive, and then all of a sudden things are very good. This is not Aquinas' read. God saw everything that he had made, the whole, granted, completed with the creation of man and woman. But it's the whole that he observes, and behold, it was very good. Therefore, the good of the order of things caused by God is that which is primarily willed and caused by God. Which is to say, insofar as God creates with himself in view and creating so that creatures can participate in his own goodness, that which God has first and primarily in view, that which he wills in creating, is how it is that the whole, the order of the whole, reflects his own goodness. This might be kind of pricking at our pride. It should. Because this isn't usually what we think about when we think of creation. It's not usually what we think that God is thinking about when he thinks of creation. The good of the order of things caused by God is that which is primarily willed and caused by God. Moreover, everything that tends to an end is more concerned with what is closer to the last end, For what is closer is also an end for others. We've kind of talked about this more or less in various ways, and how it is that the higher you go on the scale of the good, the better it is, the more noble it is, the more diffusive it is, the more it reflects extensively the goodness of God, at least his own extensive goodness. Now, the last end of the divine will is its goodness, to which the closest thing among created things is the order of the universe. Not the human creature, not the angel. The order of the whole. Since to this, every singular good of this or that thing is ordered as to an end. As what is less perfect is ordered to what is more perfect. Thus, every part is found to be for the sake of its whole. Therefore, that which God cares for most among created things is the order of the universe. That's Thomas putting us in our place. Literally, you know, within the good of the whole. In summary of this point, I write on 264, 265. Thus, the distinction, the ordering, and the inequality that obtains among created things. Earlier in his text, Taconic looks at each of these, or at least highlights these three things. The distinction among creatures, not just according to their multiplicity, but also according to their variety. That within creation you have things as low as rocks, that you have things as high as the human person, all within one whole. The distinction among things, the ordering among things, not only are they distinct and just randomly arranged, but they have an order to them, which is determined ontologically, according to how it is that they reflect the divine goodness intensively, extensively, and on the scale of those two patterns of reflection. And also their inequality. It's just true. And again, this might, you know, offend our modern sensibilities, that not all things reflect the divine goodness in the same way, by God's design. So the distinction, the ordering, and the inequality that obtains among created things, three qualities that manifest for Aquinas God's design for the universe's goodness and perfection, confirm for de Koninck the error inherent in what he reads as the personless doctrine of the primacy of the person. To elevate the particular good of the individual over the common good, rationes speciei, rationes generis, rationes similitudinis analogiae, is ultimately to defy the divinely established order of the universe in which diverse creatures, oriented to each other and to God according to their unequal perfections, form a whole that is itself, qua whole, oriented to God as the greatest created representation of his divine goodness. In other words, Taconic is saying it doesn't the human person no favor to imagine the dignity of the human creature to lie somehow apart from his being a part of the whole. Because to remove then the human person from his place within the whole and the consideration of the whole is in a sense to at least eclipse how it is that God designed not only the universe, but his own providential plan for man's happiness as a part within the universe, within the cosmos, within a created whole for which other kinds of goods within that whole are perfective of the human creature, not just only individually, but also socially. By elevating the particular good over the common good, the personalist forgets that neither the human individual nor his particular good can replicate or supersede this representation, the extensive representation of the divine goodness. Instead, man's intensive perfection forms an ordered part of the extensive perfection of the universe. So not only does the human person have his proper place within the universe, the cosmos, as an intensive representation of the divine goodness, he's put in the cosmos with a whole collection and network of extensive goods that represent the divine goodness to him, provide him the goods that augment his own being, in which he can find and kind of arrive at his simple happiness, which all conduce to, in the order of grace, the enjoyment of final beatitude. So for the rest of our time today, I'd like to just maybe make one more observation, and then we'll open the floor up to questions. Reading again the chapter that I assigned today, I realized how much it covers De Koninck's kind of fight with the personalists, and I thought it might be best to avoid some of that, just so that we don't get distracted from the conversation here. It's all interesting and important, but I don't want to get sidetracked by some of those issues. If, however, you do have questions about that and want to raise them in the Q&A, that's fine. Like John Demers last night, though, I'll decide whether or not to answer the question. The last observation, I think, the last of De Koninck's observations about the common good that I think it'd be good for us to examine is that something we've already raised, a topic we've already raised, but how it is that the particular good refers always to the common good? And that's by, again, divine design, just built into the metaphysical fabric of creation, how it is that the particular is inclined to the common insofar as the imperfect is inclined to the more perfect. So I try to summarize this point on page 248, if you want to follow along. The particular good's natural orientation to the common good stems from all of the features of created goodness that we have seen De Koninck explain in Primacy, including the objective superiority of the common good to the particular good, which grounds nature's intelligent ordering to the common good. Within the human creature, this ordering assumes a special shape. Every person is so ordered to his common and proper goods, ratione speciei, ratione generi, and ratione similitudinis analogiae, that he can neither seek nor enjoy his proper good, ratione individui, outside of reference to them. To put it another way, the human person so bears the note of part, of a species, of a genus, of created being, that this note obtains at all times, even when he, the person, pursues his individual good. Thus the person eats, sleeps, clothes himself, and preserves his life as one for whom the family, the city, the order of the universe, and even God remains his greater and the greatest goods. De Koninck underlines, therefore, that the person's virtuous enjoyment of his particular good will naturally involve some reference of the particular good to the common good. And here I'm quoting De Koninck there. We have in fact so perfect the note of part that rectification in relation to the individual good can only be genuine if it is conformed and subordinated to the common good. Again, this is my summary. This is because, again, the human person never loses the note of part, which is integral to his identity as a rational and political animal. The individual flourishes not by distinguishing his individual good from the common good, but by perfecting his individuality within the common good. To be a good human being is to act always and everywhere in reference to the common good, all the way up the scale of the bonum sum. And finally, why don't we just take a quick look at a short text of Aquinas that confirms this point, or at least for Descartes. It's from where he derives this point. It's from the Summa Theologiae, the Secunda Secundae, question 47, article 10, response to the second objection. He who seeks the common good of the multitude, this is Aquinas, he who seeks the common good of the multitude seeks in consequence his particular good also. And for two reasons. First, because one's particular good cannot exist apart from the common good of family or city or kingdom. Thus, Maximus Valerius says of the ancient Romans, they would prefer to be poor in a rich kingdom than rich in a poor kingdom. Second, since man forms part of the household or city, it is necessary that he evaluate his particular good in view of what is prudent regarding the good of the multitude. For the good disposition of the part derives from its standing within the whole. As Augustine says, every part not acting with its whole is repulsive. We can get some commentary on that in a second. So all that's by way of saying that when we look at, the very complex way in which we're created to represent God's goodness, the complex way in which the whole cosmos is created in order to represent God's goodness, because it does have and enjoys a divine ordering according to God's own wisdom and how it is that he knows how it's best for us in his creation to reflect his own goodness. There's a certain ordering and orientation of all goods, one to another. So I just wanted to underscore a point I tried to make earlier, is that these goods in themselves don't come into conflict, that they do enjoy a kind of natural ordering, particular goods to common goods of the species, of the genus, of all participated beings. We can complicate that network, just in our own lives, and especially in sin by disordered desire. These goods can certainly come into conflict. But I think the wisdom of Aquinas here is that in living our lives and making the prudential decisions for our lives, that it's a sign of human maturity and a way in which we reflect God's goodness within ourselves, is that the ordering that we find among goods in themselves, that we do the best we can to establish that same ordering, in and around ourselves over things over which we do have governance and can exercise prudence. But even more than that, that we, by grace and prayer and discipline and lots of trial and error, reflect even within our own appetite the ordering of goods among themselves, higher to lower, nobler to less noble, and that we love them accordingly, that even in our own sense appetites, but especially in our will, the way in which we choose to love these goods and pursue and enjoy them, it is according to the order that God has established among them in his providential design of all things. So it's within that then view of the whole, an appreciation of God's providential ordering for the whole, and how it is that he's made us as subjective creatures within a wider whole, within a wider cosmos, with other goods that express God's goodness in different ways, but lead to our perfection, that we understand ourselves to be human beings, but also beings of a certain kind, parts of greater wholes, not just of the universe, but also especially for our purposes here of the family and of the city, that even those wholes have orientation to higher beings, higher goods, the good of the cosmos, and finally, God himself. So why don't we, in there, and we can open the floor for questions. It gives us a good half hour or so to review any of these points that we've looked at.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, one of the most essential distinctions made to advance the claim against the personalist is that there is a kind of formal distinction between man, you know, qua individual, and then, individual, qua species, qua, you know, and citizen, and so on. I'm just wondering, like, how, almost like polemically, that argument can be made as opposed to, you know, merely a material distinction, as
right.
opposed to a formal distinction, or like, you know, I could say that I'm, you know, a citizen insofar as, like, I materially need the defense of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in a formal way, it's just that, like, part of me is reflected in the city, or the city is reflected in me.
Right. Right. I think that's a little hard to do because I think, I mean, those kinds of kind of descriptions of domestic life and civic life as basically providing need fulfillment, I think it's hard to back out of kind of an individualist kind of corner there because ultimately, I mean, you're referring even the existence of those goods simply to the fulfillment of individual need. Whereas I think for certainly Aquinas, and you find those kinds of descriptions in Aristotle. Aquinas repeats them. But I think for both of them, they see a whole lot more, you know, going on. That there's something that's prerequisite even to the question of our need, because we're created as beings with these needs within a wider cosmic context that has the kinds of goods already available, you know, to supply for those needs. And that it's built into our nature that we construct the kinds of social goods that in which not only we have those needs met, but then we can actually achieve goods that lie beyond just individual need. As Aquinas said, yes, in the text we looked at yesterday, kind of our moral, you know, perfection, you know, can take place. Not just living, but living well. And we're creatures of a particular nature where those social realities are required, you know, for that. I don't know if that.
What do you view that you kind of have to advance arguing for, like, formal imperfection? You know, so it's not just like the needs as such are not just like
right.
defense or I need food, but
mm-hmm.
there's something formally about my person that's deficient.
Sure, and that's, I think, I mean, what we saw just on the first day, I mean, talking about the convertibility of being and goodness, that our simple existence isn't sufficient to provide, you know, our simple happiness. I mean, the baby who comes out of the womb, you know, you know, crying, not quite happy, you know, in that moment. Good that it is. And has a certain perfection, a desirable perfection. It's better that it is than that it isn't. And that, in fact, in crying, I mean, it's in a sense acting to defend them, to keep itself, you know, in being. So that's already a perfection. But there are potencies already, I mean, built into his nature that require time, other goods, you know, other people, you know, to. So I think it's just, it's an anthropological point that, in fact, no man is an island. I mean, we're all intimately dependent upon each other.
Not just material.
Not just material, but yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I would argue that we need to go, the argument has to go below or beyond the limits of the material to make this intelligible. Because I think if you stick with the material, then you're just talking about individual need fulfillment, which I think is where pretty much most of us or our contemporaries are, you know, in terms of understanding these things.
So one of the background conflicts here is, of course, between de Koninck's understanding of the Thomists and the personalists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this distinction between intensive and extensive notion of the good and creaturely imitation of mind goodness
mm-hmm.
Is a very helpful distinction to understand exactly what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he certainly, and I think, is correcting kind of prideful overemphasis on kind of an individualistic
mm-hmm.
Notion of freedom and dignity that I, qua individual,
mm-hmm.
and only qua individual, have that
right.
dignity. So, I mean, I think that the good personalists,
mm-hmm.
I think they approach the good in general in the universe more intensively.
Right.
So they look at, you know, the good of the whole person. You know,
mm-hmm.
the person is not merely a part.
Right.
But is good as a whole, and that extensively. I mean, the good personalists, they want to deny the extension of the common good and
right.
you know, our participation in the common good
right.
as parts
right.
In that whole. But I think that that distinction kind of helps
right.
Show
sure.
where exactly he is disagreeing with certain personalists.
Mm-hmm.
That basically in the denial of the extensive.
Right. Yeah, and that the extensive is, in fact, defining. For the human person, because I think there's a way in which you can even accept kind of this, but then see, well, as the closer one gets to God, and some of the personalists do talk about this. I mean, kind of the more whole they become,
mm-hmm.
the more kind of the extensive world is kind of left behind. You know, the less important those goods become, the closer one gets to God, and that gets under de Koenig's skin, because what he wants to say is that no. That's, in a sense, a kind of denial of the goodness of original creation, you know, that it's not just that the cosmos is simply a stepping stone for our spiritual nature, you know, to ascend to God. Yeah. It's, in fact, no, that it is the creature that God elevates and saves is the creature for whom the extensive cosmos is a perfection. And, in fact, it's as a cosmos that God saves. It's not just individual human beings that God saves. He saves individual human beings insofar as they are members of their family, members of their cities, parts of the cosmos, which is why we speak of, you know, the celestial city, you know, that these, this social quality, this extensive quality of the created realm is going to find its some supernatural perfected representation in glory. Yeah. So there are parts of it, again, De Koenig argues quite quickly, you know, as he goes through. Sometimes it's just, he makes this the point. He identifies the problem and attempts to solve it in one sentence, and then he moves on. This is one of those, and so he does spend some time on it. I mean, the main response that's made to him by Father Eschmann, a German Dominican teaching in Canada at the time. It's interesting that the whole of their dispute that follows the original publication of Primacy focuses on, in large part, God as a common good and beatitude, you know, as a common good, and how we're to understand that within this context. Father Eschmann, to kind of writes a book-length response, you know, on this question. So that's interesting to look at. Just to your first point, I think it is true, again, De Koenig has a very focused criticism of personalism, which is to say, again, not personalism writ large, but just on this point, that there's a way of promoting a primacy of the person that effectually separates, you know, that creature that intensively, you know, represents the divine goodness from the goods that represent God's goodness extensively. And that's all wrapped up in the elevation of the particular good over the common good. And that's what... and so there are personalists who do avoid this. So in the conclusion of the dissertation, I do look at Cardinal Karol Wojtyła, Pope John Paul II. I mean, when you read his philosophical essays, especially from the 60s and 70s, on these points, you see, my goodness, how different he is from, you know, those personalist writers, you know, of the 30s and 40s that really kind of drove the movement. For example, I mean, he looks at something like, you know, Buber's, you know, whole discussion of the I-thou, and says that that's kind of incomplete. And like a Thomist point of view helps you to see that, that in fact the I-thou has to resolve in something higher, what we call the we. You know, that there's not just person to person, you know, as if the other person is just somehow instrumental to me discovering the I of myself, but know that it's in coming together in the embrace of some common good that unites us, the I-thou becomes a we, and it's within the we that I discover myself. kind of create a greater appreciation of the I that I am in the context of the we. So there, Wojtyła, and he says it explicitly, I mean, he talks about the primacy of the common good over the particular good here, in kind of personalist terms. And so I think that's actually pretty exciting, pretty helpful, or should be for a lot of our contemporaries. So I think Wojtyła was a good example of someone who kind of formed in the Thomist tradition, but beginning from kind of the personalist concern, attempts to answer personalist questions, but from a deeper appreciation of the greater tradition. Yeah,
kind of going off that point. And I think it is kind of tempting to like read Deuteronomy as he's just like, beat down your pride, submit to the order.
right.
You're not really an individual. But I think it was helpful, towards the conclusion, you kind of really like emphasized this notion of desire and that it's really that like we're being called toward like a greater form of desire and transcendence in a way.
Right.
And I think is maybe like part of what he's trying to say to the personalist, because I think maybe like Trace was pointing out, to be fair to a lot of personalists, they have these ideals of like communities of love and of friendship.
Right.
But then maybe Deuteronomy is trying to say like if you don't have some kind of like notion of community in your anthropology, you can't really sneak that back in.
Right.
So you can't just have like individuals and then you like
together. Yeah, no, I think that's clear in something like it's always hard to bring up Maritain in these kinds of contexts because, you know, Deuteronomy himself claimed that, you know, Maritain wasn't the specific target of primacy. But then if you read Deuteronomy and you read Maritain, you're okay. It's like, okay, there's something going on here. I think it's within Maritain because he's got this distinction of the personal and the individual, you know, and man is communal only in terms of his material, you know, individuality. Not so much in terms of his kind of spiritual personality, because that's just oriented directly to God, but he still wants, you know, friendship. You know, he still wants that kind of at the personal level. So, but what does he have to do? He's already relegated what for Aquinas is the principle of friendship, the common good. I mean, it's kind of built into the structure of the cosmos and a kind of human society. It's built into the anthropology. But with that kind of distinction, Maritain kind of strips the principle from the anthropology. So what becomes then the principle of friendship for Maritain in the mature person? His spirit of generosity. The principle is then interior. He has to locate it within the kind of spiritual person so that persons, out of an abundance of their own kind of generosity, pushed by their own generosity, enter into friendship, into relationships with others. So they're not drawn together by some external good, but rather by some internal force, you know. And I think to me that's a kind of admission that, yeah, that Maritain's quite far, you know, from this. Whether he intends it or not is another question. But so I do think that's where we are kind of in contemporary discussions of things. We do want to, because we have such a kind of mistrust of that which is outside of us, or at least a mistrust in confirming that which is outside of us, those things that we need, especially for our higher goods, the temptation is to locate the principles of all those interior within the individual. That means then, who are we really loving in loving the friend? You know, it's not so much the friend, it's me. You know, because I'm actualizing my potency for friendship, which is an interior principle. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could speak for Aquinas to this question. So for him, every creature is like God, but certain creatures are so like God that they're called images, humans and angels, because they're intellectual.
Right.
And I'm just noticing this long passage about how the universe is the most like God. And so
right.
I'm wondering, for Aquinas, why doesn't Scripture say that the cosmos is in the image of God? Or why doesn't it employ some other distinctive term?
Right. Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is hard because I think it's easy to kind of go heretical somewhere in here, so you do want to kind of tread lightly. Because I think in trying to appropriate what Aquinas and understand what he's really trying to say, you don't want to kind of downplay the imaging of God in man and angels. But it's just hard to get away from passages like the one we read. I mean, it's not like Aquinas is somehow weak on the Imago Dei. He's not. He's quite firm in his understanding of the human person as made in the image and likeness of God. And yet, he goes on and on and on about kind of the order of the cosmos as that which is most perfect, that which is closest, you know, in representing God's goodness in creation. I think it'd be safe to say that for Aquinas, part of the marvel of the cosmos is that it has within it the Imago Dei. So that the consideration of the Imago Dei isn't to be undertaken apart from his place within the cosmos, as has been, you know, just one element of a wider creation. But that within the wider creation, you actually have one creature that so represents God's goodness that he's the actual image. But that imaging doesn't remove the human creature in the multiple ways in which he's connected to and is a part of the whole. So I think it's not to oppose the intensive and extensive again. It's just, I think we have to think harder and maybe if Aquinas doesn't do that himself, I think he gives us all the tools to understand better, articulate better how it is. What is the relation within the whole of the intensive and extensive is?
God created the universe by his word. And the word incarnate is the perfect image,
mm-hmm.
which elevates the human image for Thomas, right? So that the Imago Dei, you can have a high view of the Imago Dei, but the Imago Dei has to be perfected according to a standard.
Right.
The perfect image of the universe is the perfect image as an effect extensively from the intensive person of the second person of the Trinity.
Yeah. And that, it is the whole that kind of, that it's not just the human creature, but the extensive whole that manifests kind of the intelligence and wisdom of God's creation, or what he wants reflected of his own wisdom and intelligence in creation. It's not just in the human creature, but in the human creature in whom there's this apparently constantly expanding whole, you know, that that we only occupy, I mean, a very, very, very infinitesimally small part of it.
Angels and humans are images also in the cosmos and a created being in a sense because they know these things.
Mm-hmm. That's right, because they can take that in them. Right.
In a sense,
And yet still remaining part of, So the thing is that our grasping of the whole, are able to kind of comprehend the order of the whole, doesn't separate us from the whole or take us out of the whole, but it's kind of the universe kind of knows itself from within, insofar as it's also known by God, it's also known by us, but that doesn't, and that increases in a sense the kind of dignity of the universe, but it doesn't remove us from being, I think that's this is Deconic's concern. It doesn't remove us from being part of the universe or the cosmos. And that it's always that kind of notion of part that informs our identity and dignity. And in fact, it's how God knows us and loves us and saves us. Because that's how he's made us. Yeah.
I just said tie this discussion in with the previous one, an example. What resource does this picture of the common good give us for thinking about better or worse states of the common good, or corruptions or perfections of it? Because presumably all polities have something like a common good by virtue of having a common life.
Right.
Being in common.
Sure.
But they can also clearly be better or worse for Thomas in certain ways.
Right. And certainly. And so he has the discussion, you know, about the best regimes. I mean, he undertakes those discussions too. I mean, I like what Chad said earlier, is that the picture that Aquinas and by extension Deconic paints is a normative one that doesn't you know, lead to direct conclusions about these things in terms of, you know, certain circumstances. And in fact, it just it paints kind of the normative picture by which to make judgments about, you know, the concrete facts, you know, on the ground. I mean, one thing that de Koninck is clear on is that, part of the totalitarian temptation of the 19th and 20th century is to identify the common good with the regime, with the good of the regime itself, you know, and not as the good of the individual citizens who, as citizens, constitute the common good. So that the political community is itself the good ordering of citizens one to another qua citizens. And to maintain that good ordering, they have kind of the instrumental means of the regime. You know, so that I think that's a good way to see, is that the kind of the regime, the form, the government, and whatever form it takes, is kind of the instrument of the citizens ordered one to another as a polity, you know, that governs their good, that oversees and organizes their good ordering. And the degree to which regimes do that, you know, I think is a way in which, you know, they're to be judged. And circumstances can, you know, require various forms of government, you know, monarchy, you know, democracy, mixed regimes. You know, those are all interesting questions. And even those can kind of take on a kind of normative quality without really answering concrete questions on the ground. But I think what Aquinas and de Koninck are giving us here is the lens through which to understand the political community as perfective of human individuals, how it is that they're constituted, and what role the government plays, you know, in the good ordering, the governing of the polis, of the political community. I mean, these are realities for Aquinas even when he talks about, you know, prudence. He identifies a specific form of prudence, you know, that of the one who wields political power, you know, within the political community. Why? Well, because the questions he has to answer are, I mean, different from those of the citizens. They, you know, exercise prudence in obedience to the laws, but the governor, you know, exercises prudence in kind of commanding and executing, or forming and executing the laws, and that's a different kind of question that requires a different kind of the virtue of prudence to exercise. Somebody that you might find helpful here, Thomas Gilby, was an English Dominican. He's the one who put together the 60 Samad. Edition of the 60 some odd volume edition of the Summa, the Latin English. He also wrote, works in his own right, and two of them are on Aquinas' political thought. One, I think, is just something like the introduction to the political thought of Aquinas. Another, what is it, from society, from community to society, or society to community, something like that, I forget. And it actually had a different name in England, than a different title there than it did in its publication here. But he goes through how, what is it that sets the political community apart from other kinds of human association? What distinguishes the political community and the role of the regime within the community, the political community? You might find that kind of a helpful discussion. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Going back to the question about the relation between the individuals of Magode, the human person, and the ordering of the whole universe. Wondering if one way to reconcile those two things would be, part of what Aquinas thinks about is unique about man and how he uniquely reflects God is that he's able to know all things in a sense. So he is all things, you know, in a sense too. So it's like, because man is, in a sense, the whole cosmos, because man can know the whole cosmos. So it's kind of, I don't know, maybe that's a helpful way to think about how you can kind of hold those things together, where both, yeah, it's true that it is the whole universe that is, you know, the the best reflection of the Imago Dei, but also it's like the man knowing the whole universe, that's also, you know, I mean, it's kind of, I don't know if it's like a way of synthesizing, you know, how they're both good and how they're both necessary for one another. They're kind of like mutually imply one another, because the whole universe wouldn't be as good as it was if it were human beings knowing the whole universe.
Mm-hmm.
And human being would, you know, be the image of God if it wasn't able to be, in a sense, the whole universe.
Right. No, I think that could be helpful, as long as, in kind of being all things, he doesn't kind of become separated from all
right.
things.
Yeah.
But that somehow elevates him so far above that, you know, he can kind of take his knowledge
right.
of the universe and exist in some other realm. You know. The other point here to make is that, I mean, another aspect of Aquinas' anthropology is just that he sees the human creature, I mean, within this, that the human creature strives for and loves his good within the same metaphysical universe as all other creatures. And so insofar as all things desire their good, insofar as they desire their perfection, and all things move towards their good according to the potencies and powers given them for that kind of movement and enjoyment, the human creature is not different from any others. It's just what separates him here is that the powers by which he moves to his good are not instinct, as we see in all of the animals, but intellect and will. And so it's by knowledge and by love. Whereas the animal moves towards his perfected good by instinct, inscribed in his nature. Man, who has his own particular nature as a rational animal, moves, performs that same kind of movement towards the good, but of his own accord, by his own lights, you know, by real apprehension and comprehension of the good, and through real love of the good, so that he governs his own action towards the good. So that's another way in which to see that even as the Imago Dei, and with the powers of knowledge and love for Aquinas, you know, those powers move, they move the creature within the same metaphysical universe as everything else. You know, this is... So, I think that's... And for Aquinas, that's the kind of the foundation of human dignity. It's just that his principles of movement towards his good and his enjoyment of the good is comprehensive and volitional as opposed to simply kind of sensual and instinctual. Why don't we take two more? One here, you know, people are getting hungry, actually.
This should be a two-part question. I have no objections
to that. Okay, sure.
But I am curious as to, like, thinking about the individual person. The Connick touches on this a little bit, and the dissertation also mentioned it, but we didn't really discuss it fully. This aspect of beatification that comes from engaging with the common good. So I'm just, it seems to me that sort of like the just thing to do, like the good thing to do is to participate in the common good, right? And we've discussed that, but is there like an excellent thing to do? Is there like an aspect of growth that can really like beatify a person in the way that, I'm thinking of beatification as sanctification, as sort of like, you know,
mm-hmm.
taking it above and beyond to just
right.
Sort of give everything to the common good while forgetting about yourself, and literally speaking, just, you know,
yeah.
giving up your life for the sake of
right.
others. And what is there space for this in Aquinas'
discussion? Sure. I mean, that raises a couple of questions. I mean, at heart there is just kind of the relation between nature and grace and what happens. Because when we do talk about beatification and sanctification, I mean, we're already squarely within the realm of grace.
Oh, exactly.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And so when you look at the whole of the Secunda Secunda in Aquinas, where he treats kind of the moral, you know, the moral life, basically man's movement, you know, to the goods that perfect, ultimately, God himself in the beatific vision, Aquinas relates, especially in the Secunda Secunda, where he's discussing the virtues, particularly the cardinal virtues. I mean, he begins usually always by giving you a kind of a natural description of the virtue. He has in view its kind of infused form, infused by charity, and so God is
right.
the object of prudence and justice and temperance and fortitude, but not the only object. I mean, even in its infused form, informed by grace, that, you know, justice still has
the view of the other, you know, in view, not just God, but of my neighbor, temperate, enjoyment of pleasure, moderate fear in the face of danger. I mean, these still remain the objects of even the infused, virtues. What Aquinas does recognize, though, is that when in certain instances, for certain virtues, the introduction of grace does change the object a bit, or at least introduce something new. So, for example, if the natural perfection of fortitude is the moderation of fear in face of the danger of death, such that you retain your grasp of the good of reason, in the face of that danger. If that's the perfection, then, of fortitude, which for Aquinas then is best instantiated in, the soldier on the battlefield. In the life of grace, it's the martyr. So it's not only just sustaining fear and danger of death, it's actually surrendering one's life in witness to the truth. So you so hold to the good of reason and the good of truth, supernatural truth, that you sustain persecution and even death, for that good. There's a parallel case then in temperance, whereas, there are many reasons why one might abstain from food, for weight loss, for physical training, X, Y, Z. In the realm of grace, fasting actually becomes a good, something to be pursued as an expression of charity. So I think for Aquinas, there are kind of little openings in the door here in how we understand what the natural perfections of the virtues are, what grace provides, how they're kind of elevated and transformed. But even within them, we recognize that there's a whole range of the exercise of the virtues, even to the point of being heroic. These are the people we beatify and canonize.
So if I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying is that there is sort of a realm of natural common good, and then that can be elevated to an even grace, to an even higher.
I mean, the principal example there, is the family. It's marriage. It's in the wedding liturgy itself, talking about how Christ, takes what it is that God has first created, made in creation, and it elevated it to that of a sacrament. It's not just a common good kind of inscribed in nature, but now it's an instrument of God to give the grace. That same community of husband and wife and child. The city actually raises a bigger question. Where's the city, the political sacrament? If we have a domestic one, it could be, the church. Insofar as it's a society, and the church has always kind of described itself in those kind of political terms.
Kings being crowned by the Pope.
Yeah.
It's a kind of sacramental.
Right.
Blessing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Mass on the 4th of July. Blessings before voting. Maybe we should institute something like that. Okay. Well, one more question.
Maybe this is more of an observation than a real question. You've been talking a lot about the good for the last 3 days,
mm-hmm.
but I found myself thinking a lot more about evil.
Okay.
And also maybe you could perhaps draw out a little bit more of how evil would fit in this system. But it seems to me that there are two observations that can be drawn based on the dissertation. The first that evil is always in relation to the particular. So if you were to find evil in all of this, it's always going to be in the extreme versions of the personalist argument. And that leads into the second observation, which I find compelling, which is that according to the dissertation, it would seem that it makes no sense whatsoever to speak of a common evil.
Mm-hmm.
Because commonality is always going to be only good. It cannot be
right.
It cannot be evil. So,
right.
So is this fair for you?
So the second, I think that's right. I mean, that sounds right to me. Even when the church talks about it, it's in vogue now to talk about structures of sin, where we want to kind of see a corporate nature, a social nature to sin. There's a way in which that's true.
But when the church is pronounced on these things, and there's not a whole lot, but it's that all of those instances of what we call structural sin or corporate sin all find their root in kind of individual human hearts, you know. So, I don't know if I'd want to say more than that, but just say that there's a recognition here that unlike the common good, yeah, there doesn't seem to be a kind of common evil. Even though I think, you know, for to kind of brings this up, so when he quotes John of St. Thomas, 17th century, commentator of Aquinas, talks a lot about the fall and, you know, to kind of draws a lot there, just about the angelic fall, that there's something about the psychology of angelic sin that in Lucifer's kind of twofold refusal of beatitude, one because it's a good that lies beyond the limits of his nature, you know, so it comes by way of gift and grace, and he sees that as repulsive, as somehow offending his kind of natural angelic dignity. Also that the object of his final happiness is to be shared with others, not only all the other angels, but even worse, with men. That these kind of a twofold rejection of beatitude, what happens then? What's his reaction? Well, he turns within himself, makes his own natural good, his highest good and the source of happiness, and then seeks to impose that on everything lower. That his own private good is then the common good of everything below him, or seeks to impose that as the common good of all. I think that's kind of fascinating and kind of ingenious, a kind of observation to make. And I think we can see that something in the psychology of human sin, you know, too, kind of in a rebellion against God and a kind of justification of putting our own particular good over and against the good gifts that he gives us. We seek to kind of justify ourselves by imposing ourselves, you know, on others. That's kind of interesting. Just remind me briefly of the first part of...
The first was that evil must always be in relation to the particular.
Your second part was kind of evidence of that.
We didn't go so far to say the person that any account of evil will always be found within the person in this case. Or is that being too unfair?
Well, maybe just taking away the word personalist, because I mean, you don't have to be a person. Just not every individualist is a kind of personalist, you know, in that sense. I think it's rooted in a kind of individualistic pride, or a pride that ends in individualism, that's kind of the enemy of the common good. But there's no, in a sense, common evil. I think you're right, because that's the whole thing that the Deconic, you know, sees, even especially within Marxism, as a kind of the final end for Marx is not the communist state, but what he sees to be as a kind of socialist state, where you don't, that communism is just a phase to pass through to kind of destroy the bourgeois world, out of which will emerge then this kind of socialist utopia. But Deconic sees it's not a society, it's just a collection of individuals who are kind of, through a kind of ruse, you know, playing everyone off of everyone else without kind of really admitting that that's what they're doing, and this is somehow how society is going to operate. So the term I use is kind of a confederacy of tyrants, you know, because each is loving that which is common for their own particular end, and if everyone in a given society is doing that, well, you don't have a society. So there is no common evil, you know, in that sense. It's just kind of a collection of individuals who are bent on evil, I guess you would say, at least in so far as it's opposed to the good. Okay. Caitlin is now standing up, which I think is our sign. Thank you all.